This episode was recorded on Monday, the 18th of May. Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thank you for joining me wherever you are. I hope you are keeping well and staying healthy. Please remember to wash your hands regularly, wear a face mask in public, observe social distancing, and remain quarantined as much as possible. And to be aware of the COVID-19 protocols that are enforced wherever you are living, as they do differ from country to country. My guest this week is Professor Shabir Mahdi. He is the Executive Director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. He's also the Professor of Vaccinology at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg. He's recently co-authored a number of articles about South Africa's route out of the lockdown, and so we chatted about how this might look, finding the balance between public health and the economy. He emphasized throughout our discussion the need for people to observe distancing protocols as an important way to slowing the rate of coronavirus infection, and emphasized that the lockdown will not kill the virus. We also discussed the changing nature and understanding of coronavirus. We began by sort of discussing just what is a virus, and then sort of into the coronavirus itself, what makes it a novel coronavirus. We discussed some of the initial thinking behind the lockdown and how, according to Shabir at least, these are no longer, or many of them are no longer, valid. We then touched on the challenge of the asymptomatic spreaders of coronavirus and how that impacts on the whole testing protocols. He also expressed concern that a number of decisions taken by the government have not been based on science. Of course, this is a worry. It is clear that we will have to live with coronavirus as best we can until a vaccine is available. And that process itself might take years, and as we see, it's fraught with political implications as well. Please now enjoy my chat with Shabir.
Shabir, thanks so much. I can't even understand the kind of days you're having these days. And every day seems to bring new information, I suppose, as much as anything else. Perhaps you could just start off. You are the professor of vaccinology at the University of Witwatersrand. If you could just perhaps start by explaining the nature of your work and the kind of areas that you work in when it comes to vaccinology in South Africa in particular.
Okay, so the research unit which I head is known as the Respiratory Meningeal Pathogen Research Unit. It's an extramural unit of the Medical Research Council, and we've been in existence for 24 years now. The focus on the unit has largely been on, as the name suggests, respiratory meningeal pathogens. And we've been pretty much involved in the study on the epidemiology of respiratory pathogens especially, and its prevention, and specifically its prevention by way of vaccination. So some of the past sort of key experiences and key contributions that we've made to science in the field has been around pneumococcal disease, which is sort of the bacteria is known as Streptococcus pneumonia, the leading cause of children dying from pneumonia, at least before the vaccine was developed. Other vaccines that we've been involved with include influenza vaccine in terms of evaluation in people with and without HIV, as well as most recently in the context of maternal immunization, where women are vaccinated with influenza vaccine and it assists the mother, protects her from developing influenza illness, also allows her to have a more favorable pregnancy outcome, reduces the risk of stillbirths, or preterm labor. And more importantly, from my perspective as a pediatrician, is that it also benefits the babies in the first 3 to 4 months of life, protecting them from developing illness from influenza itself. Other work that we've been doing around the field of respiratory pathogens is also the first study globally looking at an RSV vaccine, which is respiratory syncytial virus, which both in high-income as well as low-middle-income countries is responsible for about all 1/3 of all admissions for pneumonia in children under the age of 5. And these results will be hopefully published soon, where we show for the first time that by vaccinating pregnant women with an RSV vaccine, you're once again able to protect the babies from being hospitalized and developing severe illness from RSV. So in a nutshell, that is pretty much what we've done. We sort of involved at a coalface in terms of the epidemiology of respiratory pathogens, and then as advanced to that in terms of prevention by way of vaccines.
I just want to know, obviously, I want to have a discussion now in the context of the novel coronavirus and how it relates to your work. You have written a number of articles recently in cooperation with certain others around the government approach to the mitigation of the virus and the lockdown. But before that, I just want to I don't want to get too sort of bogged down in the science too much, but if you could just perhaps explain to me what a virus is and what makes the coronavirus novel in the context of what we're dealing with, this pandemic.
So for all intents and purposes, despite the amount of havoc that this virus is inflicting, both in terms of health, in terms of social structures, in terms of the economy, as well as previous viruses, as an example, the Spanish flu, it's quite sobering to realize that viruses, in fact, are not living organisms. They do not fulfill the basic criteria for what constitutes a living organism. And essentially what it is that it's a germ that's around in the environment or it's present in other hosts, as an example, and obviously humans. They've got a large percentage of the composition that is actually made up of virus as well, that we live fairly comfortable with. But what the virus really requires to be able to survive and replicate and to spread is some sort of a host. In this instance of the SARS coronavirus 2, the natural host for that virus appears to be bats. And it's by having jumped the species barrier that is from bats, probably through some intermediary into humans, that it has become what we call a novel virus. So it's novel insofar as our bodies have not been previously exposed to it or a similar sort of virus to some extent at least. And consequently, because our bodies haven't been exposed to this sort of a virus, we don't have underpinning immunity, which allows us to ward off the full potential effects of the virus. But I'm just qualifying that because this particular virus, the SARS coronavirus 2, belongs to a group of viruses, of which there's at least two other viruses that do circulate in humans. That is known as HKU1 coronavirus and the OC43 coronavirus. Now, those viruses, in fact, are very common in children. In South Africa, as an example, if we were to sample healthy children, roughly about 12% of children will have one of four coronaviruses, which are sort of what we call seasonal, more endemic coronaviruses. And it might well be that because of that exposure to those viruses, that children have been able to develop some level of immunity, which might not be long-lasting, but at least is sufficient in terms of duration of time, which provides some level of cross-protection against this novel coronavirus. And consequently, children have somewhat been spared a severe disease and death from this coronavirus. But in the adult population, although they might also have been exposed to those coronaviruses, the frequency of exposure might be less. And consequently, they probably don't have the same type of immunity as children do, as an example. And I'm not saying that that cross immunity is what is the main reason for why children are protected, but it possibly is one of the reasons that is being advocated as being why children are being protected. Now, it obviously becomes even more of an issue outside of a healthy adult population in terms of individuals that are immunocompromised, as an example. Once a person becomes immunocompromised, for all intents and purposes, you sort of lose this type of what we call adaptive immunity that has been established. That is, after exposure to a germ, your body mounts an immune response that's very specific to that germ. And upon re-exposure to that germ, you're able to mount an immediate immune response to it. And it might be that once you become immunocompromised, be it because of diabetes or chronic other medical problems, that ability, you lose that sort of memory responses to this particular germ that you might have previously been exposed to, and consequently you become more susceptible to developing severe disease. That obviously is coupled with a whole lot of other physiological changes that take place when someone has diabetes or hypertension or chronic lung disease. There's other physiological changes that take place, such as an increase in terms of the expression of the receptor that's required for this virus to sort of enter into the human cells to replicate. So there's a number of factors at play, but that, in a summary, is why this is a novel coronavirus, is that the majority of the population probably has very little immunity, underlying immunity, to basically ward off the full effects of the virus. But at the same time, we do know that almost 95% of people that are infected, including adults, over 95% of adults that are infected would either be completely asymptomatic are only mildly symptomatic. So that means that there's certainly something else that's happening. Is either they're what we call an innate immune system, which is sort of the first line of body defense against a virus, either that is clearing the virus very quickly, or there's some underlying element of adaptive immunity, which is what a body has, which has been induced in a body after past exposure, that is sort of militating against the full effect of the virus in healthy, full potential effects of the virus in healthy individuals.
It seems, I mean, I'm finding it still quite difficult to understand what it is we're actually dealing with here. And I mean, I'm not a medical professional or a scientist, I'm just a curious citizen. But it seems that there's sort of new information emerging pretty much on a daily basis about how the virus works, how it affects people, and what the after effects are. What for you over the last couple of months, at least since the pandemic was actually declared by the World Health Organization, that was a couple of months ago now, I don't know the exact date, how has your understanding of coronavirus and COVID-19 changed?
So I think what you mentioned is really important, is that the amount of new information that's coming in is sort of reflected by there being over 11,000 articles on COVID-19 in the scientific literature alone. That is without the many opinion pieces around it. And that 11,000 is over a period of about 3 months, right? So that's a huge amount, volume of information for any individual to process. And as you mentioned, our learnings of the virus in terms of new manifestations that were previously not recognized is sort of increasing exponentially on a daily basis. So what are some of the key issues? So I think when we had initial experience from Wuhan, there was a very sort of select impression in terms of what the virus was causing, what type of disease manifestation existed, what was what we call a case fatality risk, as an example, and which groups of individuals were susceptible to developing more severe disease. It was sort of an experience in one country, in one region, and whether that was going to translate out in other parts of the world, we didn't really know. But since then, there's been a number of new learnings, which sort of helps us to better understand the virus. But at the same time, there are a number of factors which remain intact and experiences from Wuhan, which remains largely generalizable to other parts of the world. So what are some of the key issues? So as an example, right at the start in Wuhan, they indicated that it was only about 2% of people that were infected that were asymptomatic. 85% of people were mildly had a mild illness, and about 15% had severe illness that required hospitalization. And they had a case fatality risk of about 2% at that stage. Now, that has changed completely over the period of 2 to 3 months in terms of our understanding of the virus. We now know that, in fact, the majority of people that are infected with the virus would be completely asymptomatic. Between 50 to 80% would be completely asymptomatic, but at the same time, they can potentially spread the virus. We now also know that of the remaining people that are symptomatic, as was experienced in Wuhan, the majority of those are going to have a mild illness, 85% of them, and 15% will require hospitalization. So that is similar to what happened in Wuhan. Obviously, the reason why Wuhan only had 2% of people that were asymptomatic is that at that stage of the epidemic, they were only targeting testing people that were symptomatic. And a few people that were asymptomatic were contacts that they followed up on. Now that we can use sort of seroepidemiology as a measure of the true number of people that are infected in a community, and we need to repeat it, but as an example in New York, where they look at seroprevalence of exposure to COVID-19, they find that 25% of people have actually been infected. Right? So that gives us better understanding in terms of the full force of infection, and then we can start calculating in terms of the number of asymptomatics, etc. And that's how we've come to this sort of information. What we also know is that the initial experience from Wuhan, as an example, suggested that this was predominantly a virus that was affecting the respiratory symptom. And many of the deaths that were occurring were acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, right? And part of the reason why the virus got its name, severe acute respiratory syndrome. But now what's evolved, in fact, is that the virus can be much more widespread in terms of its pathology. It can affect the brain, it can affect the heart, it can affect the lungs, the kidneys, etc.
Was it kidneys as well, I read now?
Correct. Yeah, and yeah. It can cause skin manifestations. So we're getting much more detailed understanding in terms of the full breadth of clinical manifestations which can arise. And now the understanding in terms of the pathogenesis has also evolved. It seems that it's a combination of a hypercoagulable state coupled with a imbalanced, robust, severe inflammatory response. So what it is, what's happening essentially, you've got a severe inflammatory response in response to the viral infection, but at the same time, that same severe inflammatory response is causing collateral tissue damage.
Mm.
Right? So it's causing your kidneys to be affected, your lungs, your heart, etc. to be affected.
So it's the actual body's fight against the virus that's actually causing knock-on impact.
Yeah. And whilst it's doing that, what it's also doing is causing a hypercoagulable state, which means that it's causing the blood in the vessels to actually coagulate, right? So it's affecting the flow of blood through those vessels to vital organs. Right? Yeah. So it's sort of a combination of effects. So it's very little to do with the virus itself. It's more to do with the host immune response to the virus and sort of a cascade of events that sets off. That's causing severe disease, that causes people to die. And it's got important implications in terms of which modality would be most successful as a treatment option, right? So targeting the virus when someone has already been hospitalized with severe disease is unlikely to be of much benefit. And we see that from the number of studies which have now shown that remdesivir, as an example, in individuals that had severe illness, it failed to work. Caltrate, as an example, in individuals that had severe disease, it failed to work. Hydroxychloroquine, exactly the same thing. So when you're targeting treatment at the sort of end stage or severe end of the spectrum of the viral-induced illness, right, it's not the virus that you need to target. It's you need to target the host immune response and the consequences of the host immune response. So that is sort of how we've moved in terms of our understanding of the pathogenesis of the virus and what we need to be focusing in terms of management.
Can I ask you just, in the articles that you've co-authored recently, you've called for a rapid move to a level 2 lockdown. I just want to, before we get into a discussion about the government's response to this crisis, at least before we get into how we might end the lockdown, I want to just get your opinion of how you feel the government has responded to the crisis from the initial announcement of the lockdown.
Yeah. So I think South Africa's government has been highly proactive in terms of its response to the outbreak. In fact, right at the start, thanks to the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, it already had surveillance structures in place and alerted to government as to the potential of imported cases. We were able to identify imported cases very soon after we realized what was happening in the Northern Hemisphere, including in China, including in Europe. And the initial 1,000 cases almost were largely based on cases that were being imported into the country. because of that surveillance system. And that surveillance system was rolled out, obviously, because with assistance of government. Now, immediately, very soon after the WHO declared a pandemic, what happened is that South Africa's government decided to go into a lockdown. And I think it's important to emphasize that the reason why South Africa went into a lockdown is very different from the reasons or the objectives as to why countries in Europe, the United States, and other places in the Northern Hemisphere went into a lockdown at the same stage. South Africa was still at a relatively early stage of the outbreak in South Africa, whereas those countries were sort of trying to mitigate the impact of the virus in terms of what it was having on healthcare facilities. So our reasons were very different. So the main reasons for South Africa going into a lockdown at that point in time, part of it might be that they were somewhat afraid in terms of what was being modeled as being the likely number of deaths that would occur from COVID-19. The initial modeling, which unfortunately was flawed, indicated that the number of deaths that South Africa could experience was anything between 75,000 to 320,000 deaths from COVID-19 alone. But unfortunately, that didn't go through adequate peer review, and it was misleading. And it's not unique to South Africa. We know the same thing happened in the United Kingdom. To some extent, the same thing happened with a global institute such as IHME. Right, they come out with initial projections that were just completely off target. But that is obviously what happens with the novel virus. And it also reflects importance of peer review before implementing policy based on those sort of uncertainties. But the biological reasons why the lockdown was probably required at that point in time is that, firstly, there was a window of opportunity in terms of to try to contain the spread of the virus. Right, it's something that you can achieve when there's limited number of cases, when you can test at scale and you're able to identify the infectious cases, trace their contacts highly efficiently, at least 80% of the contacts, and put a contact into quarantine. And then you can aspire towards containment. Whether it was ever achievable is unlikely. Simply because even with our aggressiveness of testing, they were still embedded problems in terms of the testing strategy, and especially when it came to the tracing of contacts. So for that sort of a strategy to work, as an example, right at the start, when there's fewer than 20 cases, you need to trace at least 80% of the contacts to achieve containment. Right? In the South African context, we were not even tracing 20% of the contacts before the lockdown. Right? So unfortunately, containment was unlikely to be on the table for South Africa as a goal. So the second reason was really to buy healthcare facilities time in terms of better preparing themselves for what is going to be a surge of COVID-19 cases. And as we see, even in high-income countries in the US as well as Europe, there's little bandwidth in terms of the healthcare facilities being able to absorb a huge upsurge of cases. Now that becomes even more problematic in less resource settings, where at the best of times, our healthcare facilities sort of functions at a margin of not being overwhelmed. Right? So something needed to take place. Healthcare facilities needed to be provided the opportunity to increase their ability to the best extent the time allows, 1 or 2 months. But also importantly is, as experienced globally, is that there was a shortage of personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. And it simply wasn't available in the country. Right, and had we allowed the lockdown just to have we allowed the epidemic just to continue rolling out without putting some sort of at least hurdles in its path, right, we would have been faced with a situation that there wouldn't have been PPE, healthcare workers would not have been protected adequately when we start seeing a surge in terms of number of cases. So we bought time to basically better prepare healthcare facilities, and I think to some extent that has been accomplished. Obviously, you can't rebuild healthcare facilities in the space of 2 or 3 months. It takes a generation to rebuild a healthcare system. Right? So this is an important lesson for the future. But we need to do the best that we can accomplish over a narrow period of time. Now, the third reason, and this is unfortunately where South Africa came short in terms of its strategy of a lockdown, is again, to be able to control the rate of transmission of the virus, what you need to do is you need to be effective in terms of your ability to test at scale, put those into isolation, those that test positive, trace a contact, and put a contact into quarantine if they're negative. Right, so you need to be able to do that. Unfortunately, the testing strategy should have been placed before we embarked on a lockdown, and not reason to extend the lockdown because we haven't done what we should have done in the first 3 weeks. So that is where we came short, right? And now the problem is that even though we've got a testing strategy in place, the number of positive cases that are being identified is so many that it becomes impractical to basically follow up on the number of contacts. Because remember, each person that's positive, on average, a person would have perhaps about 20 close contacts per day. In low-resource countries, probably even higher, where the density is higher, probably even a greater number. And you need to trace the contacts of an infectious person from at least 3 days before the person became symptomatic up to the time point when a person went into isolation. So as an example, if someone goes into isolation on day 3 post-onset of symptoms, there's a total of 6 days of contacts you need to trace, which roughly comes out to about 120 contacts per person. If we're diagnosing 500 new cases, that means you need to follow up at least 5,000 of the 6,000 contacts to be able to contain the spread of the virus. And that obviously is not practical. The United Kingdom, Germany was different. They managed to accomplish it. They managed to accomplish it because they've got a highly efficient system in terms of testing, in terms of tracing, in terms of quarantine.
The South Korea was also another.
South Korea, another good example. Singapore, another good example. But at the same time, those countries also reflect some of the problems when you actually go with that sort of a strategy, in that you are vulnerable to outbreaks. Right? So you need to be able to sustain that sort of a strategy at least until a vaccine becomes available, actually, not just for the next 3 to 6 months. Right? So it's a long term, it's a marathon. This is not a sprint that's going to last a few minutes. Right? This is a long term strategy. So you need to be able to sustain it, which is also the important part. But like I said, in South Africa, the reality is because we don't produce materials for testing from the swabs to the kits that are required in the laboratory, we're competing against the rest of the world to gain access to those sort of materials, right? And the reality is that we're way down in a pecking order in terms of gaining access. So even though the laboratory services might have the theoretical capacity to test 56,000 samples within a 24-hour period, as soon as they reached testing 10,000, as soon as they were taking 10,000 samples per day, there was a 5 to 14-day backlog in terms of the results, which effectively makes testing a meaningless exercise. Because by that time, when the person is screened in the community and they get the result back a week later, that person, in fact, is not infectious or very less infectious than they were when they didn't have the result. So, in addition to that, the further problem that we have is that by just overwhelming the laboratory services with the limited resources they've got, we're undermining the care of people that have got an acute illness. So someone comes to the hospital and they need to have a test to find out if it's COVID-19 or not, because it's going to determine their management, and it's also going to determine how the healthcare workers, what type of equipment they use to protect themselves when managing that individual. And what was happening, essentially, is that all of the samples were going into the same sort of pipeline, no prioritization. So the person that was admitted to the hospital was also going to wait 3 to 4 days for their result compared to the person in the community. Right, which again makes it, which means that a number of people, healthcare workers, are going to have been exposed to that individual that was admitted to the hospital unknowingly until we get the result back. So the system itself and the resources simply don't lend itself to that sort of testing strategy, which WHO advocates. But I have to say, WHO are not interrogating their own recommendations in terms of the practicalities of implementation in low middle income countries. And that is a huge problem.
Yeah.
When WHO says that you need to be able, you can only lift your lockdown when you're able to test and make sure that you place in a context as 2 of the 6 conditions for lifting a lockdown, that is nonsensical, irrational in the context of low middle income countries where there's such limited ability to test. Right? And that messaging from WHO needs to be clarified because it's creating more harm than good in low middle income countries.
So is the, because the way I see it now, there's the kind of the personal component, which is wash your hands, socially distance, and quarantine as much as you can. And from the state or at the state or government level, it's the test, trace, isolate strategy. Now you're saying that on the government side, that test, trace, isolate is not really going to work. There's going to have to be just a pure health response to a hopefully lower or mitigated rollout that will be the result of us washing our hands, keeping our social distance and quarantining. Is that a sort of fair assessment?
Well, there's a balance. So the test trace quarantine strategy in its current form, which is dependent on PCR tests, is not an option any longer in South Africa. And it's less of an option in other sub-Saharan African countries, where the ability to test at scale is even more limited compared to South Africa. So that is not an option. But what is other options? So the United Kingdom, and I think Germany and other countries, have developed an app, which with a reasonably good level of predictive value tells someone whether they might be symptomatic from COVID, from the SARS coronavirus or not. Right? And if they turn out positive, the app result comes back that you're likely to be infected, that person needs to go into self-isolation. That doesn't need any testing. That person can share with his close contacts that I'm very likely to be positive. Those individuals, depending on their conditions, need to take the appropriate measures that they don't end up in spreaders. And if conditions allow, they need to go into quarantine. Right, so we need to become more innovative in terms of how we approach trying to identify infectious cases, especially at a community level, in terms of trying to control the rate of transmission of the virus. I'm not saying that we need to get rid of the lockdown and go back to pre-COVID era. That is not what we're saying. Right? We need to accept that we need to operate within the realities of our resource constraints. Right? And what is it that is within our grasp? So using technology, smart technology, to be able to at least make some assessment. It's not going to pick up everyone that's infected. In fact, even in Germany, as an example, you're not screening the entire population. You don't know those that are asymptomatic, that are infected, that are spreading the virus. And that makes up the majority of people that are actually infected, although not necessarily the majority of people that spread the virus. Right? But at least if you can take out a percentage, a reasonable percentage of those that are infected and actually keep them out, we're able to slow the rate of transmission of the virus. So that's the first part. So we need to use technology to basically assist us in doing what our laboratories aren't able to deliver on. The second part of it is that we need to, so the only tool that we've got available to us, the only tool is, or what's in our toolbox, are the non-pharmaceutical interventions, like what you mentioned, the wearing of non-surgical face masks in public spaces, the hand hygiene, physical distancing. And then in terms of government policy, it's about keeping mass gatherings banned. You can't have mass gatherings because we've seen, even in South Korea, as soon as they lifted the lockdown, right, they had a flare-up of cases because of one disco. So that is the lesson, right, that you can't permit mass gatherings, right? So it is about using those non-pharmaceutical interventions together with government regulation around mass gatherings. And then it's really, at the end of the day, the success for low-middle-income countries to be able to contain the rate of transmission. And people need to go away from the notion that you can prevent infection, because that's not what that is not what this virus is about. And we can't prevent infection. You can prevent infection if you're an island nation such as Iceland and New Zealand, where you shut your borders from the rest of the world and you can self-sustain yourself at huge economic cost probably, right, and wait for a vaccine to become available. If you're in that sort of unique position, yes, you can. In the low middle-income countries context, you cannot achieve that under any circumstances. So it's about trying to slow the rate of infection rather than preventing infection. And the only way that is going to work is if the citizens of the country understand the reason why they need to aspire towards a goal, right? It's unhelpful if government projects the image or the notion that we're going to prevent infection from taking place. People need to understand that infection with a respiratory virus is almost a fact of life. It's going to happen, right? And it's all about trying to slow the rate of spread of the virus, trying to slow the rate of that infection so that our hospitals don't become overwhelmed with a sudden surge of cases. So rather than having everyone infected over a period of 2 to 3 months with everyone just going about merrily and doing nothing, right? Rather than spread it out over 6 months, right? For at least for the first wave of the virus. And then we're going to come up with a second and a third wave. And we're going to need to cross those bridges when we come across them. But we're going to need to have the same sort of toolbox at hand in terms of slowing the rate of transmission, even when the second and the third wave comes. But unless the citizens of the country buys into that concept, and unless there's adherence to those NPIs, unfortunately, the only thing that's going to happen is that the virus is going to continue spreading at a much greater rate than we desire for it to spread, and it will cripple healthcare facilities.
So there's a couple of things there. I mean, just on your sort of understanding of where the healthcare system is now, is it kind of ready?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you can't build healthcare systems over a period of 2 months. So the healthcare system is better off than where it was before the lockdown. The amount of PPE available is better than where it was before the lockdown. Is it sufficient for the surge of cases that you're going to experience? Very unlikely. I mean, it's not about ventilators. In fact, there's no reason to have ventilators in low-income countries when a country, when New York, as an example, reports a 90% mortality rate in ICU on a person that's ventilated, right? So there's very little reason to actually be putting money there. Money needs to go into having additional beds in hospitals, needs to be going into having oxygen points, security of oxygen delivery. There are more basic fundamental issues, which is going to allow us to save more lives than trying to reach, than trying to aspire for things which has got such a poor success rate in terms of improving survival. Are we better off than where we were 2 months ago? Yes. Are we adequate? The answer is no, and we will never be adequate. You can't build a healthcare facility in a space of a few months.
I just want to go back to that point again about quarantining and social distancing. I suppose we do need to understand that the large majority of our population live in poverty, or at least are very poor. They live in very poor housing, usually crowded, more than one person to a room. So, I mean, even at that level, it seems an impossible task. And I mean, my understanding is that in a lot of parts of the country, life has just kind of gone on, as it were.
Yeah. So it's an impossible task to prevent the spread of the virus. But even within those conditions, it's still plausible and possible to basically control the rate of infection. And I think we need to, it depends what lens you look at it from. Like I said, in terms of preventing infection, it's impossible. And even in high-income countries where those conditions don't exist, they didn't prevent the spread of the virus. Right? They were able to control the rate of infection, and that is what really needs to be understood, is controlling the rate of infection. So even under those, it becomes more challenging in those sort of conditions that you describe, right, to be able to control the rate of infection. But it's not beyond our scope to do so, right? Even if the doubling time of the virus has changed, of new infections as an example, it's changed from 3 to 4 days to 8 to 10 days. Right, that each is usually accomplishment. Mm. Right, maybe we want it to be 15 days or 3 weeks. Right, but even a 2 to 3 day difference in terms of the doubling time has a huge impact in terms of what is going to occur when there's a surge of cases requiring hospitalization. So we're not going to be absolute. We're not going to be 90% effective with our interventions. Not even 50% effective, and that's not what we're aspiring to. We're just trying to do as much as we can, as best as we can, to slow the rate of transmission. Right? And people need to understand that people are going to get infected. Whether you keep schools closed or not, children are going to get infected. Whether you keep businesses closed or not, people that go to work are going to get infected. Right? And that is what we argue, that a lockdown has served a specific purpose. Right? Continuing the lockdown doesn't serve any purpose because right now our healthcare facilities, in fact, are completely underutilized because there aren't any cases. But it doesn't, unless we can afford the luxury of being in a lockdown until a vaccine becomes available, probably about 2 years from now, right? You don't have any other options, right? And the only option you've got is that there needs to be some level of return of normality into society, right? But at the same time, we need to have our sort of roadblocks in place to try to prevent the rapid spread of the virus.
So any return to any kind of half normality will automatically mean an increase in the number of cases?
I mean, that's the reality. And I mean, we're not even too sure to what extent the lockdown in many of the communities that you described, we're not even too sure to what extent the lockdown actually reduced the rate of transmission of the virus. I mean, during the course of the lockdown, before the lockdown, we were having 80 to 90 new cases. In the last 2 weeks of the lockdown, the last week of the lockdown, we were having 400 newly diagnosed cases. And that is even at a time point when we weren't actually testing 30,000 individuals, which is what we were aspiring to, but only testing 10,000 individuals. Mm-hmm. So transmission has continued. Community transmission has continued even during the lockdown, especially in the least resource settings in the country, probably more so than in the middle class community, where people have the luxury of being able to be 2 to 3 in a house and able to stockpile food and everything else and minimize the need to go out. And those are the realities. Right, so whatever we do, right, even if we go back to level 5, community transmission is going to continue simply because households aren't able to, the majority of households aren't able to adhere to conditions of a lockdown because they live from hand to mouth on a daily basis.
Just before we go into sort of how we might progress out of to a lower level of lockdown, this asymptomatic spreader seems to be an almost impossible challenge to mitigate against.
Yeah, and that speaks to the issue that we can't prevent infection. Right, so we need to accept that there's asymptomatic individuals. In fact, the majority of people that are infected are probably asymptomatic. They're going to be transmitting the virus, but the only way that we can prevent them from transmitting the virus very freely is for them to adhere to the same sort of NPIs. And that's the reason we don't just ask people that are symptomatic to wear a non-surgical face mask. We ask everyone that's going out into public spaces to wear a non-surgical face mask. We don't just ask people that are symptomatic to wash their hands or people that are asymptomatic to wash their hands. Everyone needs to adhere to the same sort of
protocols
and physical distancing. So you can't be within 1.5 meters of someone that's asymptomatic but keep a 3-meter distance from someone that is symptomatic, because that asymptomatic person is still going to transmit the virus to you if you're not keeping a physical distancing and if that person is not wearing a mask. So the tools that we've got, irrespective of whether you're symptomatic or not, applies equally in terms of what we're trying to achieve.
Are there any other lessons to be learned from other lower to middle income countries that we could sort of implement even at this late stage? I'm thinking perhaps Cuba or Vietnam.
So I'm not too clear exactly what Vietnam did, which allowed them to pretty much contain the virus, spread of the virus, right? And not with that much testing, which is of concern, right? So I'm not too sure exactly what they've done, but whatever they've done has worked for them. The reasons why they were successful, unclear to me, to be honest. Is there any other lessons that we can learn? For me, the most important lesson right now is for other countries to learn what is happening in South Africa. For other sub-Saharan African countries to learn from what is happening in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And number one is that the lockdown, despite what all politicians might believe, or the majority of politicians believe, does not eliminate the virus. Right? And I think that's a good starting point. Right? That the notion that you can go into a lockdown and eliminate the virus is a false notion. Right? And that's what everyone needs to first accept in low-income countries before they have a knee-jerk reaction to going into a lockdown as soon as the first few cases are actually identified. So that's the first lesson. The second reason is the essence, how essential it is to be able to maintain essential healthcare services and other essential services. Right? What we've seen in South Africa in a 5-week period of lockdown is the number of people that have been tested for tuberculosis has decreased by 50%. Right? The number of people that have been diagnosed with TB has decreased by 1/3 in a 5-week period. Now, WHO itself estimates that if there's a 15% reduction in the number of tests that are done for TB, you can expect, if there's a 25% reduction in terms of the number of tests that's done for TB, you can expect 15% more people to die from tuberculosis. Now, what does that mean in South Africa? Each year, there's 66,000 people that will die from tuberculosis in South Africa. There's about 350 new cases of TB diagnosis in South Africa each year. Right. If we continue on this trajectory where people are not coming forward to be tested and the diagnosis is being delayed, they are at greater risk of dying from TB. They're also posing a risk to other people in the community that they're transmitting TB while they're not being diagnosed. Right. Effectively, what we're lending ourselves to is that the indirect effect of the lockdown, right, to try to prevent COVID disease and COVID deaths is going to be much greater than the direct effects of COVID, of the lockdown, right? or the direct reasons for the lockdown. So the direct reasons was to prevent COVID mortality as much as you can, right? But the indirect effect of it is that healthcare systems are being pretty much incapacitated to deliver essential healthcare services, right? And TB is one example. We're facing a similar scenario when it comes to HIV, right? In India, they showed roughly a 70% reduction in immunization for measles, right, very soon after the lockdown was implemented. So children are not getting vaccinated against life-threatening diseases. Right? Children are really going to die from COVID-19. But UNICEF estimates that because of the absence of the lack of interventions, or the scaling down of the lack of interventions required for maternal health and child health, that what's going to happen with COVID-19 is that an indirect impact on childhood mortality is going to be anything of an increase of between 250,000 to 1.2 million children will die because of the indirect effect of COVID-19. So these children are not going to die from COVID-19, right? But they're going to die because they're not getting basic essential healthcare to healthcare services, which are required to ensure that children survive, especially in their first year of life, including immunization, including nutrition. So there's a whole lot of things that we're not thinking about in our unidimensional focus on COVID-19. And those are important lessons that other sub-Saharan African countries need to start thinking about now. Some of them already gone into a lockdown, and they need to start thinking about what is the harm they're doing with the lockdown, rather than what is the good that they're aspiring toward with the lockdown.
I just want to talk a little bit, touch a little bit on, you know, you mentioned people sort of understanding what the government's trying to do. I mean, how do you sort of gauge the communication around the government's actions? Was it perhaps wrong to make it make the president the spokesperson for this whole project, and rather put a health department bureaucrat as the face of this? Or I mean,
I think in the context of such a huge public health problem, it is completely appropriate for the president to be taking the lead. In fact, my criticism would be that he's been not seen often enough. I mean, in the UK, we see Boris Johnson as an example almost on a daily basis, giving a debriefing, even when he was at home under isolation.
Even though he does sound quite confused at times.
Himself. Yeah, but I'm not talking about the content. I'm talking of, I'm really talking of just his presence. And obviously, it helps to have good content behind what you're saying. So I think it's important for the president to show leadership role, right? But it's important also for him to ensure that he's getting the right advice from a broad group of people, right? And that is where we fall short, unfortunately. Some of the messaging which he is articulating, that is not his thinking, and I think we need to be clear about it. He's articulating messages to the public which his advisors are giving him. And unfortunately, some of what has been articulated lends itself to problems. But when making a comparison of South Africa, where South Africa is after the first 100 cases being diagnosed compared to the US and the UK, it's not a scientifically sound comparison to make on a number of fronts, right? Because the reasons why we are at different stages and a different number of cases that have been diagnosed after the first 100 cases are more than a handful. So I'm not going to bore you with that. But it's not a proper type of comparison to make. And it's unfortunate that someone advises him to make that sort of a comparison, right? Perhaps to show the country that the lockdown is working, but that not doesn't reflect that the lockdown is working. So it's important to have the president as a public face in terms of how we need to proceed, right? But his discussions and what he says needs to be informed by proper scientific opinion and not by one or two people. It needs to be, I mean, I think Germany, as an example, they've got the Robert Koch Institute, which together with the federal government comes up with policy and recommendations. Right? Other countries have got an independent scientific committee. Sweden, as an example. The independent scientific committee makes the recommendations. Government then decides whether they want to enforce it or not, or whether they want to accept it or not. And if they don't want to accept it, they explain to the nation why they decided not to actually go with the scientific advice that they've got. And government reserves that right. But that scientific advice needs to come from an independent group. Or at least they need to have latitude in terms of being able to tell government what it is that needs to be done as a collective.
But there is the Ministerial Advisory Committee that's made up, I understand, of a wide range of people, including healthcare professionals, scientists, academics. What is the role there, or is that is there some other political component to this that we're not perhaps fully understanding? I'm thinking more about the internal, perhaps ongoing struggles within the ANC itself. How do you see the role of the Ministerial Advisory Committee there?
Yeah, so the MAC has got very specific terms of reference, and it's got a very specific mandate. And that is, it's only asked to basically make recommendations on issues which the National Department of Health requires a recommendation to be made on, right? Uh-huh. So the MAC is not, unlike an independent scientific committee that can take a holistic approach and basically opine on any issue, right? The terms of reference of the South African MAC is specific that you will tell us what we ask you to basically apply.
So it's responding to specific questions. It's not being proactive in terms of how it assesses the situation.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And what's happened, culminated essentially, which is unfortunately what came out in the media over the weekend in South Africa, right, is that key strategic issues essentially have not been discussed in the MAC, right? Key decisions that are made by the National Command Council are not discussed in the MAC, right? So that lends itself to the type of ridiculous type of regulations that come out from other departments, including trade and industry, which allows people to buy one type of shoe but not another type of shoe, right? Yeah. And clearly, it doesn't pass any sort of measure of rationality to have those sort of recommendations. But those things, I mean, we wouldn't even have gone to that detail of what shoe to buy. You need to take it at a more macro level. That's what is your strategy? What is it that you want to do? So the MAC wouldn't have opined on the type of shoe. But it's an example where the key issues and what the key things that are coming through from the National Command Council essentially, I would say, are not based on science. And we need to be about it. Right? The National Department of Health might be one of the ministries in the National Command Council. Right, but the decision making in the National Command Council is not based on science in South Africa, which is very unfortunate because, like I alluded to, it's causing more harm related to non-COVID issues, both in terms of society, in terms of poverty, in terms of health, in terms of the economy, than any good that it's causing.
Because I mean, I'm one of those people who's wanting to believe that the government is acting in all of our best interests in a very dramatic and demanding situation, probably the biggest crisis the world has faced since the Second World War. But you kind of implying that the thinking is wrong, even at a political level.
I'm saying the decision making is completely wrong. I mean, it's the recommendations speak for itself. As an example, the creation of tunnels where people are sprayed before they enter into a taxi or into a shopping mall, right? In fact, if anything, that is harmful and can increase your susceptibility to getting infected than doing good, right? There's no evidence that it would actually kill any virus inside the body when you spray someone on the outside, right? It makes absolute no sense, right? And in fact, the chlorine that's used can cause irritation of the respiratory mucosa, increase your susceptibility to become infected if you're exposed, right? So like I said, they might be believing that they're doing everything in the interest of the citizens, but the reality is that in absence of actually engaging with scientists as a collective, right, the decision-making, unfortunately, has been highly problematic and if not scientifically flawed at multiple occasions.
Oh, man. How do you sort of see our way to some sort of... What is the path that you and your fellow authors, particularly in the latest article that was in The Conversation, I think on Friday, could you just give us some sort of idea of the steps that you feel would allow us to at least get to level two, which would allow for more sort of economic activity, more opening of facilities, schools, etc.?
Yeah. So look, at this point in time, it makes absolutely no difference in my mind whether we're at level four or level one. Because the toolbox that we've got at hand and our ability to control the rate of transmission of the virus is not dependent on what level we're at. It's completely dependent on society as a whole buying into the NPIs. Right? So we can pretty much go back to level, we can go to level one tomorrow. Right? And if people are abiding to the NPIs that we've described, we're going to be able to control the rate of transmission. Right? If we're at level four and people are not abiding to the NPIs, right, we're going to see a surge of cases. So it's an academic issue in terms of level one and level four. It creates some perception that we might be able to control the virus and the rate of spread, but it's a false perception. right? It's a misconception that we're controlling the rate of transmission by having different stages of level. It's also a misconception that you can basically have different districts at different stages, different levels, depending on the number of cases in a particular district. The districts in South Africa are literally separated by a road, right? And to tell me that district A and district B need to be on level 4 and level 2 is a meaningless exercise, right? So we need to be rational about what recommendations we're making, and it needs to be underpinned by logic and science. Right? So there isn't the science to describe everything, because we're still learning on a day-to-day basis. But there is logic at our disposal, right, to think through what is implementable, what can we achieve with different sort of approaches.
I want to now just touch briefly, as we come to close, about vaccinology, about developing a vaccine. It seems now, unfortunately, that it's almost become an arms race as to who develops a vaccine first and how that will then be used as a kind of club or some kind of, it'll almost be weaponized in some respects. I mean, do you have that concern? I mean, how are you viewing it just from your perspective, the global response to developing a vaccine, and how you hope that might pan? Apparently, there's a meeting today, in fact, of a global sort of conference on developing a vaccine. But there certainly seems to be a number of different camps. And again, it's about, you know, a national project or an international project when it comes to developing a vaccine.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, this is not the first time that we've experienced this. It just become more focused in public attention because it's an immediate crisis. We need to just remember that for many life-saving vaccines in children, it's taken anything between 5 and 20 years for life-saving vaccines to become publicly available in the majority of low-middle-income countries. So there's a vaccine against meningitis known as HIP conjugate vaccine, which took 20 years to become available to more than 80% of children in low middle income countries compared to when it became available in the United States. The pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, which prevents the major causes of death from pneumonia in children, took anything between 5 to 10 years. So this is not the first time that low middle income countries are pretty much again being put down in a pecking order in terms of when they might be able to access vaccine. But this time it's become more acute because it's also high income countries competing against each other, right, for these vaccines. Right? And that's the reason why it's gaining the traction that it has, unlike the past, where it was more of an issue of, well, we sort it out in high income countries, we can take our time to sort out what happens in low middle income countries. Right? And that was the paradigm that we operated in the past. So where are we now? Yes, it's unfortunate that countries are insisting that the vaccines that are produced in those countries by their manufacturers will be first prioritized for their population, because it's got absolutely no moral defense, because what you're wanting for vaccines to happen, what you're wanting with vaccines to happen, is you're wanting to basically send it out not to all the countries, but to those individuals in different countries that are at most risk of developing severe disease. And that should be our priority with the first batch of vaccines that becomes available. It's protecting the most vulnerable, right? It doesn't help to be vaccinating a healthy 18-year-old whose chances of dying of COVID-19 is less than dying in an accident, right, when you've got a shortage of vaccines. So it's a moral issue that we need to deal with. It's an ethical issue that we need to deal with. So there's going to be limited supply of vaccine, and there's no getting away from that. There's no company that's going to set up a facility to produce billions of doses of vaccine for 2 to 3 years, and after that, they only need to manufacture 1 million doses of vaccine, because that is what it is. Right? We need to develop vaccine. We need billions of doses in the next 2 to 3 years, and beyond that, we're going to need millions of doses to perhaps target a specific group of individuals that still remain susceptible. Right, so the entire model in terms of vaccine development, in terms of vaccine manufacture, in terms of vaccine access needs to be thought through. Right? But unfortunately, I'm not optimistic it's going to happen, because we've got Trump in the United States who's made it clear that there's no vaccine that's going to leave the United States. And we've got European countries that have also already shown, just as an example with test kits and with PPE, right, that they ban the export of those sort of tools to other countries because there was a shortage in their country. Right? And I would be surprised if countries and governments in high-income countries are not equally selfish when it comes to a vaccine. And that is selfishness. It's morally reprehensible, and it doesn't speak to humanity.
I mean, just As we finish now, how do you see now the next couple of years, and how do we learn to live with COVID in the world?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's not going to be business to usual, back to normal until we get the vaccine, and I think that would happen before the multiple waves of this pandemic sort of subsides. So I'm hoping that, or at least that's what I'm hoping, that the vaccine becomes available before the next 2 to 3 years, over which we'll experience multiple waves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is that the amount of damage that this virus has caused, I mean, the health front is probably the least relevant right now. It's the most acutely relevant part of it, but in the broader scheme of things, in fact, it's the least relevant. A country such as South Africa, which lost revenue, the receiver of revenue lost 280 billion rand in income, right, over a period of the expanded lockdown. That is more than we spend on our annual health budget each year, which is about 200 billion rand for 2021, right? We're going to have huge shortfalls. The current estimates in terms of GDP is going to contract anything between 10% optimistically. And the pessimistic scenario that I just recently heard is that it can contract to 30%. Right? That means the country is going to need to lend more, need to borrow more money. That means a larger percentage of the budget is going to be spent on paying interest. That means there's going to be less money in terms of sustaining things that we were able to sustain even before the lockdown. Right? So I'm not an economist, right? But it would be faulty of me not to speak about economy, about the impact of the economy in the context of health, right, that the effect the lockdown is having and the effect that an unmeasured response to COVID-19 in South Africa is having with regard to the future of the country. And I'm just talking of health. The same thing would apply to housing. The same thing would apply to social grants. The amount of resources that's becoming available is contracting day by day in terms of us being able to expand those programs. There's going to be a contraction of those programs, which is going to impact on, which is going to have an ongoing impact on the livelihoods of people for at least the next decade on this current trajectory.
On that rather pessimistic note, unfortunately, but realistic note, Shabir, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Okay, thanks, Nicholas.
Thanks, take care.
Okay, keep well.
Bye-bye.
There was a lot to grapple with in that discussion. I'm still, I suppose, unclear in my own views on how this whole thing should be managed, from full quarantining to opening up, without restriction, all activities, which I think is kind of off the table. But, you know, how do we go forward is still, for me, difficult to contemplate. I suppose my main takeaway was the need for maintaining social distancing as much as possible. But as we discussed, you know, even this basic requirement from individuals is very difficult for people living cheek by jowl or having to use public transport, taxis in particular, to get around, to get to work. And people do need to work. I mean, that is another significant component of all of this. So, yeah, sobering discussion. But, you know, whatever steps are taken, either individually or by the government, the virus will continue spreading. It's not going away. As he said, this is a marathon and not a sprint, unfortunately. I was interested in his suggestion on the use of technology, sort of self-diagnosis apps, but that does then again, I suppose, raise issues around privacy and use of individual data. Shabir again emphasized the need to use non-pharmaceutical interventions as much as possible, wearing masks in public, socially distancing, and the government maintaining a restriction on mass gatherings as being important mitigation efforts. So wash your hands, wear a mask, keep your distancing. be safe. Consult your local health authorities for advice if necessary. Thanks again to Hindenburg for their support. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting and is practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information and sign up for a free trial. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Deezer, indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.